Kate and me, we were both scared when we learned from Todd, we have to start the shoot with doing all the scenes with the orchestra. And we have to do it at the very beginning. And for her, she plays the beginning, the middle, and the end. So for me as Sharon, that was great because I saw the whole character of Lydia when we went back to our apartment. So in a way, it was fantastic to start like that and to have this, that was very special.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Awardist, where we are chatting with the actors, creators, and more who are contenders this year. And we are, of course, breaking down the state of the 2023 Oscars race. I'm Entertainment Weekly Executive Editor Jared Hall, and I am joined again by EW Executive Editor Clarissa Cruz and Senior Movies Editor Joshua Rothkopf. Hello to you both. How are you?
Hi, Jared.
Hi, Jared. You're doing good. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you. I do got to say, we have a packed show today. In addition to the Golden Globes being tomorrow, we're going to preview that a little bit. We have two amazing interviews. I'll tell you more about those in a second, because first, a very important housekeeping item before we get to all the action. I have some kudos to share as our wonderful Clarissa is moving on from EW, but she is not going too far, friends. She will be joining our wonderful colleagues at People Magazine as executive editorial director there. It's a big job. It's a big role. And we could not be happier for you, Clarissa. So congratulations
Yay.
On that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That's so sweet.
Yeah. Well, admittedly, we are, of course, very sad to lose you, especially for these conversations that we have here on the podcast so often.
I think you should still do the podcast.
Oh, I bet we'll still rope her in maybe for another one.
You can't
but I'm
going to
put you on the spot here quickly. No, not forever. Putting you on the spot. What is an award season or specifically an EW career highlight?
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Honey.
you need days to think about that.
Yeah, let me think. Oh gosh,
there are a couple things that I know are not highlights. Some stories we've worked on together that I will not bring up.
Well, I have to say, I think the highlight. I don't know how many people know this, but I started my career at EW years and years and years ago, and initially covered the Oscars red carpet, and that was super fun. But then I had a second stint at EW more recently. And I think the highlight of that would probably be the cover we did with Ben Affleck.
I knew you were going to say that. I don't know why, yeah. But I knew you were going to say that.
I love that one because we got Matt Damon to interview him. And yeah. I was just so surprised at what a good journalist he was. He asked all the questions that we asked him to. And it also ended up being a really good conversation. So
yeah,
I would say that's probably a highlight.
Love that. You know, total tangent here, but because we got Ariana Grande to interview Jennifer Coolidge for our Entertainers of the Year, I got to say, I was sitting on that Zoom with them. Ariana Grande wrote all of her own questions, speaking of, you know, stars who are good journalists. And she was great. She had such amazing delivery and wonderful questions. And anyway, but
she
yes,
did.
I know what you mean. It's always fun when the stars interview each other.
So you're saying that if Ariana's career doesn't pan out with music, she's got a job with EW.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
if those
Matt.
Wicked movies don't work out for her.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
She has a fallback. Okay. So look, We obviously, as I said, we have a lot to still chat about here this week. So let me tease it a little bit, but let me tell listeners who we have on today's episode. From Sarah Polley's movie Women Talking, stars Claire Foy and Ben Whishaw, and from the movie Tar, Nina Haas. And let's start with Nina. I got to say, she's been on a bit of a roller coaster this award season. It seemed early on like she was a lock for a nomination. Then it wasn't. Then for a while, it was looking good again. Now it's a bit iffy. So I pose this to you, Josh. What do you love about Nina's performance opposite Cate Blanchett in that movie?
Nina Haas is such an extraordinary presence. She's someone who acts with her eyes. And you watch Tar, which actually is a very verbal movie, especially for Cate Blanchett. But Nina Haas is doing the counterpoint where there's a lot that's spoken by her performance without words. And I don't know if you guys ever saw Nina Haas's breakout film, Phoenix. Did you guys ever see Phoenix? This is in 2014. This was the movie that kind of put her on the radar. She, it's a German movie. Nina Haas is German. And, and it, it's a movie about a woman who survives the Holocaust, but she is disfigured and gets full plastic surgery. And her face is apparently completely different than the way it was before. And she decides to reintegrate herself into her life as another person and reconnect with her ex-husband who sold her out to the Nazis. And so the whole movie is this fascinating, like, Hitchcock thriller. And the whole thing is basically done with looks and glances. And she's the kind of actor who I think is so transparent. You see through, somehow are able to see through to the emotions without a lot of words. And Tar is definitely her best performance. I can't even imagine Tar working as well as it does without the sort of the yang that she supplies to Cate Blanchett's yin. We need her as a counterbalance in it. And you're right in the sense that her Oscar fortunes have slightly faded. They've gone up, they've gone down. She is definitely on the bubble, but she will be back, if not this year, then some year.
Yeah. Well, and that's why we have her on here, because we want folks to be paying attention. And I know what I will be watching tonight, Phoenix. I'm going to find that. So thank you for enlightening us on that one.
New favorite film, though. You get ready for it. I mean, it really, okay. Brace.
Good to know. All right. Thank you. And then in terms of women talking stars, Claire and Ben, Clarissa, those two are really, they're also kind of on the cusp to get into the Academy's top five. What do you think they have working, one, in their favor, but also working against them?
Well, I mean, both of them are super strong performances. And I'm going to start with Claire, because I thought, you know, in a movie that's packed with amazing female performances, hers was the one that really personally got to me because of her character's storyline as a mother who's just outraged at what's happened to her child. And I just thought that was the most emotionally impactful, at least for me, story in a movie full of stories. And so I thought she was completely mesmerizing. It's definitely a departure from things that I've seen her in the past. So I thought that that was fantastic on her end. For Ben, you know, this is a movie about horrible male behavior. And his character is sort of the person who takes down the notes during these meetings of the women talking. And his character is sort of the polar opposite of what they're talking about, and just kind of showing humanity of men in a movie where so much of it is about the inhumanity. And so I think both of them are standouts in this cast, and that's what they have obviously working in their favor. Working against is that it's a very crowded category for both of them. You know, the supporting actor slots are very crowded. It's a movie that's very serious, and not that serious movies can't get their due at the Oscars, but I think a quieter kind of, hate to say downer kind of movie, but very powerful. And I think that that kind of may be working against it. That said, I do hope that one or both of them make it.
Yeah, I wouldn't particularly call either of them, maybe her more than him, flashy performances, right. You know, especially when you look at the field of, you know, potential nominees when we're looking at, well, certainly Jamie Lee Curtis, who seems to be kind of emerging as the front runner, maybe, you know, that movie, it's such a wild showcase for her. But yep. All right. Well, and by the way, worth noting, Women Talking. I mean, folks really are loving this cast. Film Independent is giving that cast, as well as Sarah Polley and the casting director, the Robert Altman Award. And the movie is on lots of other lists. So certainly one for folks to pay attention to if they have not seen it yet. They should. All right. So the main event, the Golden Globes, are tomorrow. All right. Josh and Clarissa, take a look into your crystal ball. What do each of you think the big headline will be following the ceremony?
I think that just to see a televised award show, and it will be like no one got slapped, you know, like
fingers crossed,
right? I'm really hoping for, you know, just for the sake of this industry, that things go smoothly, that there's laughs, that like a true Golden Globes telecast, there's self-deprecation, there's, you know, self-mocking, not taking itself so seriously. I'd love to see the people in attendance, you know, drinking and enjoying themselves. That's part of what makes the show special. What about you, Clarissa? Is there something you're waiting for?
Yeah, you know, I kind of am two minds about it because I think it'll be interesting for me to see, because we're in the industry, we cover the Golden Globes, we cover all these award shows, we know about all the backstories and the controversies. And so we kind of go into it with a certain mindset, like wondering whether the Hollywood Foreign Press has done the work and whether, you know, this is something that should be legitimized again. But then there's also the general public, who mm-hmm. sees, you know, the Golden Globes as like the one where everyone drinks and has fun and is merry yeah. and, you know,
the big
stars, the big party. And just seeing how that balance plays out, you know, I might be even like, I think maybe too much inside baseball to see, but I want to know, you know, whether the general public, whether the audience is good to sort of welcome it back with open arms, and whether it's business as usual again.
That's all. Certainly folks are paying attention to that. We're going to dive into that even a little bit more later. I wonder if the big headline may not be, and this will be wonderful timing since Oscar voting is happening next week, that the big headline might be Everything Everywhere All at Once sweeps at the Globes. That's what I'm wondering.
That would be fun.
And I would love to see it. I would love to see it.
Yeah.
Speaking of that movie, star Michelle Yeoh, Ke Huy Quan, and then also Colin Farrell for Banshees of Inisherin. It feels like the three of them seem to be locks in their respective categories. Is there a race, a category that each of you are particularly paying attention to?
Yes, I need clarity on Best Director.
I
want the Golden Globes to, it's not necessarily a direct correlation, but mm-hmm. for example, I mean, we know the nominees for Best Director already. It's James Cameron, Martin McDonagh for The Banshees of Inisherin, Baz Luhrmann for Elvis, the Daniels for Everything Everywhere All at Once, mm-hmm. and then Steven Spielberg for The Fabelmans. If the Globes were to say, give the Best Directing Award to the Daniels, like you say, in a sweep mm-hmm. for Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think that might be some kind of a perception, some kind of a boost for them in terms of potentially breaking into that bracket for the Oscars. I mean, that Best Director race is so tight, and that fifth slot, no one really knows who's going to, is it going to be the Daniels? Is it going to be Sarah Polley? Is it going to be, mm-hmm. you know, someone we're not even thinking of? And so Any insight into that Best Director race, I think, would be much appreciated.
Yeah. And, you know, we so often say that the Globes aren't very much of a predictor of the Oscars because, historically, looking back so many years, the Oscar nominating window closed before the Globes happened. So
right.
they couldn't have any effect anyway, but that will be very interesting to see what that does this year. Clarissa, what race are you paying attention to?
Well, I'm kind of paying attention to all of them because they have because they divide the categories between musical and comedy and acting. And I think it would be so fun if some of the kind of out there ones get into the Oscar race because of a win here at the Globes. Like you said earlier, I don't think it's a huge predictor. There's not a ton of overlap between the voting bodies, but it is, right. as you also said, timed in a way that it could have, you know, just the fact that someone's going to get up there and get the chance to make a speech. I mean, that's just as much of the campaigning as the actual work itself. Mm-hmm. So I think that'll be interesting to see how that plays out once that comes out. And I really, you know, I think this is the time that some of those unexpected contenders can get some shine.
Yeah. I will say the one category in particular I'm so curious about is Best Actor in a Drama, because Austin Butler has shot to the top, even over Brendan Fraser, but they're still fairly neck and neck. If you take a look at, you know, some of the experts in the field who they're picking, that one's going to be really interesting. I could see that being one that Austin Butler could win. He's not going to win at the Oscars, but I think he actually has a great shot at the Globes.
Elvis does feel more Globesy, right?
There's
something about something more Bozzy, more Globesy. And if Austin won and then went up there and gave some, you know, a beautiful speech like he's been doing on the circuit, and remember we talked about the bounce that he got from SNL. You know, that can't hurt. You're an Oscar voter. You're watching the Globes at home. You see Austin, you see how, you know, poised he is, mm-hmm. you see what a star he is. I mean, that could definitely affect the way you vote.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, Clarissa, you touched on this a bit, but I posed the question this way. So the HFPA is, for all intents and purposes, they are putting in the work. They, you know, are working to diversify their membership and dealing with all of those things that they have promised. But by all indications, nearly all of the nominees are going to be in attendance. They have also wrangled some great presenters. So the question I pose to the both of you, are the Golden Globes officially back?
I think yes, they're back because, you know, they're going to be televised and it seems like attendance is going to be good. Like as an event, I think it's back. If it's the event that it has been in years past, I'm not sure yet. Just because, it's a different time. It's a Tuesday night. I don't know what that has to do with anything. But I, it's one of those things that I think you'll be able to feel right away, once it happens, once we're all there, as you're going to be as well, Jared. I want to see what that in-person kind of feeling is going to be and also how that translates to whether people are at home are watching and interested.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, that answer would be yes, they're back with a big asterisk. I'm fascinated by how they're going to address this in a way that's both public facing and accessible because they're putting a show on. So they don't want to kind of like tear their garments and constantly be talking about all the problems they've had. That wouldn't make for a good show. But when you have people like Jared Carmichael, when Tarantino, when he goes on stage, he's going to be one of the presenters. I think there are going to be opportunities for the Globes maybe to do a bit of rebranding during this telecast, which is going to be, it's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah. Eddie Murphy's going to be up on that stage. He could roast them a little bit too. We'll see.
Yeah.
It has all of the ingredients for a fun show. But yeah, time will tell. I'm very curious on the carpet where I will be. If any of you are listening and your publicist, find me, bring your nominees, bring your presenters by. I will be there. But if they will even stop to talk is what I'm curious about, because I'm sure there's that fear of like, we don't want to talk about the HFPA. We just want to be here and have a good time. And there might be a little bit of a fear that those kinds of things will be asked. But yeah, it's a fun event. And hopefully it continues that.
I'm sure they'll want to talk to you. I'm sure they'll want to talk to you, Jared.
I mean, of course, obviously, they're going to see me in my full black tux and be like, him over there. That's the one. Yeah. But, you know, we will have full coverage at EW.com. So, of course, I encourage all of you to check that out. We will have the show covered. And we have lots of these movies covered, which we're getting to the interviews right after this quick break coming up on the awardist women talking stars, Claire Foy and Ben Whishaw. We'll be right back.
Also,
no one
more about gel coat
when the fourth round.
Don't you call in the?
Don't touch that dial. That's right. We're still calling it a dial here because it's Emmy season on the awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers every Thursday starting April 4th as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with the awardist podcast Thursday starting April 4th on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at EW.com/awardist. Welcome back to the awardist. You know her as Queen Elizabeth II, and you, I hope, because the movies are so great, know him as Paddington Bear. Here they are, women talking stars Claire Foy and Ben Whishaw.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Hey, Devin.
Hello. We're all right, aren't we?
We're good.
We're good.
Yeah.
Good. Well, I'm so excited to get to talk to you guys about this film. I got to speak to Sarah a little bit earlier. And yeah, I mean, I'd love to start by hearing from each of you guys. You know, take me back to when you first encountered this book or this script. What was it about this story that hooked you the most and made you want to be a part of it?
Lots of things. I think Sarah is a really exciting and incredible director. So I was already interested in her choice. I think her choices are really interesting. So I was already interested before I even read the script. And then I read the article, which is based on the actual factual rapes that happened. And then I read the script or the novel. I can't remember which order I read them in. And I just thought that the script was so faithful to the book. And also, like nothing else I'd ever read, it was so unique. And all the characters are so clearly drawn that I would have done anything to do it, really. I would have, I was very surprised, but very grateful that it did. I was actually in it.
I feel the same. I'd never read anything like it, and it was so, like, it wasn't an easy read.
But it was,
you got such a reward for the challenge of it, and I was very moved by it.
Yeah.
And yeah, really wanted to work with Sarah. Mm. And then we did a reading, didn't we, on Zoom?
Yeah, which was a sort of catastrophe, I think. Like various
stages. We nearly lost the parts then.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, it was a miracle that we made it through. But that was amazing as well because it was in lockdown. And so it was seeing you and Fran on a Zoom.
Yeah.
It was pretty, pretty amazing.
So you guys did a read through like on Zoom before you guys like ever got to meet and like rehearse. Is that right?
Yeah.
But like maybe 6, 7, 8 months before we...
Yeah. It wasn't an immediate phone call. Dragged on. The pain of not knowing what was going on dragged on. But it was more of a what they frame it as in this industry, which is like just exploring. It's absolutely no pressure. They just want to hear it read out loud, which is just a complete lie. And there's a lot of pressure.
And it's all an audition.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty much. We made it through.
We did, yeah.
Well done us.
And now you're here. And yeah, I'm curious, you know, we see a few flashbacks and a few scenes in different locations, but the vast majority of this film takes place, you know, on a single set, kind of in this hayloft, you know, in this barn. What was the vibe like, you know, kind of being in that space with the same actors kind of day after day?
Overall, I think the vibe was very positive. I think the main theme of the whole thing was just it was very joyful.
Very.
It was very collective and like a community. And then there would be up and down days because of the material that we were shooting and because of also the endurance it took to film in a sound like a barn in a barn, you know, a barn in a studio. I've never done anything really green screeny or like that before. So it was, the endurance of the material and also just, you know, being in a studio and keeping it alive and fresh and,
Yeah, I mean, I think for you women, it was so hard in terms of like having to repeat long stretches of text again and again and again to get the coverage, don't you think?
Yeah, but it was hard. You had to sit there and listen to it all.
Yeah, but that's easy by comparison.
And stay awake. I don't know whether it is.
I don't know how you all did that, actually. And didn't sort of flag ever.
But I think it's because we were so committed to each other in the process that I think... I know why I did. I was like, I can't... I've got to be there for everyone else. Like, you can't just... It was very apparent. It couldn't... Not that it ever is, I suppose, a job where you take it easy and phone it in, but... that you couldn't have a break. Like, you always had to be engaged and always on because someone was doing something different every time. Someone in that room was always doing something.
It's true.
And the focus was always different all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a lot of fun as well.
It was. We did have a laugh.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that really struck me about watching this film is, you know, it deals with, you know, these really heavy themes and some very heavy moments. But there's also like these lovely little moments of laughter and lightness and joy. For you guys as actors, how did you want to kind of navigate that tone to kind of strike that balance?
I think it's completely necessary. Otherwise, the film would feel very heavy. I think Sarah kind of understood that. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite bits of the whole film is an amazing moment, and because I know you and Jesse, it's even funnier and more brilliant, is when you're still taking the minutes, and she laughs and she says, he's still taking the minutes. There's something so genuine about that.
Yeah.
And you're really watching someone laugh.
Affectionately.
Affectionately, yeah. Even though... We always hope. Yeah, but, you know, like, I think it was, there was so much love in that room anyway. But, yeah.
And I think all of you have great humour as and, people and performers. But, yeah. But you, do you know, so that just naturally came out in moments.
That's something we all shared, I think. Yeah. And that's because Sarah does, I think.
And yeah. Sarah is hilarious, actually.
Yeah. It's yeah, yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? Because sometimes you work, people have a sense of humor, like no sense of humor. Like, we're very lucky that people did. It would be a very different environment if it didn't.
Yeah.
God.
That helps, absolutely. And yeah, Ben, that was something I wanted to ask you about. You know, you spend a lot of this movie in silence, you know, being an observer, you know, and you're obviously a participant in it, but, you know, there's some of these long, powerful scenes where you're, you know, kind of on the fringes. What was that like?
Well, it was just amazing because it was like being in the front row of an amazing play, really. Watching amazing actors who I have admired for a long, long time. And watching them close up and watching them, you know, working. So like finding things and repeating things. And I don't know, it was so interesting on a level of like the craft of watching people working their craft, and then also just on a human level, it was amazing because for all the reasons Claire said, it was just a very loving room. And we would go from the set back to this sort of shared green room. Well, actually, it was a grey room.
Yeah, but it was so grey. Everything.
It was the greyest room you've ever seen. but we all had a little sort of, well, they gave us a bed eventually, didn't they?
Eventually we got given a little mattress.
A little mattress. So we were all together all the time. There
all
were
the
dogs,
time.
There were babies.
We slept members. Together in that room. Like, it was basically like
you were doing your You were doing your house up.
I was doing my house constantly going, what does everyone think of this? I know. No, but it was, we were living with each other when we were at work that whole time.
Yeah.
God, it was
because
so
usually
funny.
Actors just go back to their trailers and you don't really see between takes, you know, between setups. Anyway,
Yeah, none of that. No. None of that nonsense.
All together, all the time, on screen, off screen, in the same room. I love that. And yeah, Claire, I know you've said that this is, you know, might be one of your favorite characters that you've played. You know, she's got this kind of white hot rage, but also she has kind of a warmth to her. For you, what was kind of the key to kind of unlocking her and kind of figuring out who she is?
I think it's both those things, basically. In the book, it's really interesting. Salome is described as of being basically a rule breaker. She's like constantly doing things to annoy people, and she's constantly saying the thing that no one wants to hear. And she would there was a sort of thing, there was one bit of the book where it was like that she might be making moonshine and like drinking it. and that she, so there's lots of reasons why she should be excommunicated from the colony. And everyone was always sort of mystified why she wasn't. And so I took that to mean that she wasn't, because she gives a lot. She's a very active participant in the community. And that means she's got a really big heart. And I think that the Salome pre and post the traumatic experiences that her and her daughter and her family members have experienced, I think would be a really interesting thing to see. But I think that's not who she is anymore. But I think that her character lends itself to wanting to fight the injustice of what has happened, and that being like energy and fuel for her to keep going. I really admired her, and I really admired the fact that she made the weather in the room. Like, I just loved it. That she and everyone let her do it, and everyone knew, oh, here she goes again, like just sort of like rolling their eyes about. But they do the same with Marieke, like there's a lot of eye rolling about, oh god, here off she goes. And the same way that Greta does with Ruth and Cheryl. Like, everybody has their thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like a cool balance where everybody kind of has their own little like role in this larger collective.
Yeah, and it couldn't exist without all those people playing those roles. The whole thing would crumble, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm curious, you know, when I spoke to Sarah, you know, she talked about how she wanted to create like a really collaborative set, you know, where she invited people to make suggestions or offer their opinions. Was there like a moment or a day on set where you guys really felt that, where you, you know, giving input, making, you know, kind of on the fly decisions and really feeling that collaborative environment?
I can't think of like an actual precise moment. I know other people have had particular moments. You know, have you heard Sheila's story about the teeth? So Sheila had to do, who plays Greta in the movie, she had to do the scene where she wakes up and her teeth are falling out as a result of the attacks. She did the scene and they finished it and everyone was like, that was amazing, da da da. And then she said, oh, I should have made my bed. Greta would have made her bed. Then moved on. We finished the film. And then on the last day of shooting, we'd all gone home, like literally on aeroplanes on the last day of shooting. And Sarah said to Sheila, do you want to make your bed? And they'd rebuilt the entire house for her to do the scene again with the bed made. Like, just because it was a good idea and because, I mean, that, I can't think of a single director who would have done that.
Yeah, that's...
Ever. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
Yeah. And that's just the extent of which she was open to everybody's
really
suggestions
was.
And asked everybody as well, like, what do you think? It was very like the film.
Totally.
Yeah.
She wanted to hear what we had to say, what we thought, all the time, right?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, that makes such a difference. And I'm curious, you know, for each of you, when you think back to filming, was there a particular scene or like a day on set that kind of most stands out in your mind when you think about this filming experience?
What was
it? Oh, God. Is it a funny one?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
You know, you know when Oche?
Yeah.
When Kate?
Yeah.
Jumps out the window and we think she's killed herself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the other women, your clucking thing?
We were...
I just remember that so vividly.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. We were just making stupid... Yeah. It was a very dramatic moment. We all had to be like... Oh! Like that, and it just got more and more hilarious and ridiculous to the point where we had to run up to the window and we were shooting and we just I think at that point they realized maybe joy was not the great thing for us to be dealing with. Like, we needed to be sad just so that we would behave.
Oh, but there was also the fart machine,
and there was the fart machine days of the fart machine. Yeah. That was very, very memorable. There's so much about it that I just... You're lucky if you have like one of those moments in something that you're doing, and every day would just bring up a surprise. Like, there would be a real surprise every day.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to chat with me.
I am an absolutely huge fan of Claire Foy, and I gotta say, Clarissa, something you said earlier, you know, it's a performance that people really haven't seen from her before, because she was so contained and controlled playing Queen Elizabeth on The Crown, and she's not as contained or controlled here. There's a lot more emotion, than we got to see from QE2. Claire Foy has incredible range. She's just a powerhouse actress.
Yeah, I think there's definitely obviously a long career ahead of her.
But I
hope she gets some due from this performance, because it was just so powerful.
And she's supplying something to women talking that it really desperately needs, which is that kind of fire. Sometimes the film can feel a little bit like a philosophy class. That's what our reviewer Leah Greenblatt compared it to, in that it's a film of ideas. It's a film about free will versus determinism. But Claire Foy is the one who's like, no, we have to fight back, you know, and she's the one that's supplying, I think, a lot of the passion in that movie. So it would be great if she was recognized for that.
Indeed. And folks, I hope will recognize Ben Whishaw from so many things. Obviously, I mentioned Paddington. He was part of all of these Bond movies as Q. Another great performance from him was in Brideshead Revisited that was the late aughts, I believe. Was that 2009? He was so good in that. He's also in Layer Cake. Yeah, The Danish Girl. I totally forgot about him in that. And then Mary Poppins Returns. So this guy is an actor who I think is also just so versatile. And I always enjoy his performances.
And he was so heartbreaking in this one, in Women Talking.
I mean, that is one way of putting it, for sure. Mm. He's so good. All right, so we are going to take another quick break. And when we come back, it is time for Dave Karger's chat with Tar star Nina Haas. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Awardist. One more interview for you here, and it is a good one. Dave Karger with Tar star Nina Haas.
Very happy to be here with Nina Haas from the movie Tar. Great to see you.
Great to see you, Dave.
You know, when you popped up in Tar, I thought, oh, I know her from Homeland. Do you feel like that prior to this is maybe something that you're most known for here in the US?
I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. I think, you know, the showrunner from Homeland, Alex Ganza, he saw me in The Most Wanted Man. So quite some people have seen that as well. So that was the, let's call it the Kickstarter.
Right, I love it.
Yeah.
What was the process for you to be cast in this fantastic role in Tar?
Well, it was kind of like my English agent, Roger Chartres, he called me and he said, Nina, Todd Field really wants to make a Zoom call with you. I don't know what this is about. No one knows. It's top secret. But will you do it? And I was like, of course. I mean, yeah. So we had this lovely, lovely Zoom call. And Todd, even there, he wouldn't tell me much about what this was all about. And he just said Kate was the lead. And I was like, well, I'm going to do this. No
matter what. It doesn't matter what it is.
Even, you know, just Todd Field was enough for me. So, and that was like, whoa. And then he said, yeah, I don't know if this is enough meat for you, but just have a read. And then I read it and I was really blown away by the script. Because you put it down and you go, what is that? We're going to make a film like that? Someone's gonna wanna do it with us? A production company is behind this. And I was just so taken by it, because you really wanna read it again.
Right.
Because you feel you've missed something, you know? And I have the same feeling watching the film. You wanna go back and because it's so nuanced, it's so fine. It touches so many relevant topics of our time. And so I was like, I'm in, I need to do this, yeah.
And so it was an offer? He said, it's yours if you want it.
Yes.
So that's fascinating. So he had a Zoom with you, didn't wanna tell you anything about it, just wanted you to read it.
Yes.
And that,
he wanted, I guess, yeah, he wanted to know if I get a connection with the story, I guess, you know, most and foremost.
Huh. When you watch the movie, it feels different from anything that you've seen before. How did it read different from anything? How did you know reading it that this was going to be a film that was unique?
Well, you know, who dares to start a film with three consecutive scenes that are, one is an interview that lasts for 10 minutes. The next one is a talk in a restaurant that lasts for nearly 10 minutes. And then I think follow the Juliet scene.
Right. Yeah?
So that is a one taker of 8 minutes. And it's all what's being thrown at you is in a way challenging because you enter this classical music world, you hear lots of names, you hear a lot about what conducting is about, you learn about time and the essence of time and things like that. So you're being slowly lured into this world of Lydia Tár, but in a very, it takes the audience seriously, I find. So that is very special and unique already. So when I said it, I thought, I can't believe this starts with this interview segment. Because also, when I say that, it's not about, you know, you don't have to know anything about that world. You just get informed that this person really knows what she's talking about.
Right.
So that these three scenes establish that really in a phenomenal way. And when you read that, you know, oh, this is something else.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you're reading the script. You know that Cate Blanchett is the lead. You've gotten past these first three monster scenes. What was it like for you then to discover that Sharon and Lydia are partners in life, partners in their careers, and all of the incredible intimate stuff that you would be doing with Cate Blanchett?
You know what, I was really only looking forward to it. it didn't scare me a bit. Because I admire her so much that I thought we can do this together. You know, I was really looking forward to also watching her exploring this immensely intricate, fascinating character, and to see what I can do to kind of, you know, be the person who highlights certain things in that, in her, in the story, but also find my own way of making Sharon seen, you know, and not just as the maybe betrayed wife. So taking her a bit out of the victim kind of side, that was then the work I was really interested in, to make it as rich and colorful and nuanced as possible.
Well, sure. You think this is the kind of neglected, suffering wife. We don't want to give too much away for people who haven't yet seen it, but
exactly. You
wonder how much Sharon might or might not be complicit in what Lydia Tarr is up to.
Exactly.
And so how fun.
That was the thing to explore. And that was something we were talking a lot about, that I'm so, because I found it in the script, but it wasn't really worked on, let's say, you know. But I thought there are certain moments where Sharon says things like the daughter is having problems in school, and then you could do that in a very innocent way, but Sharon knows who Lydia is and what she's probably going to do. So that informed me about Sharon in a way. Is she also someone who holds the kind of power system up that they're in? You know, that can, who, so it's something that we thought about while shooting the film, and hopefully open a conversation, because people who watch it will think about it, but in a non-judgmental way, you know. So it's just, you can think about Sharon and how much, when does she decide to not say anything, to maybe not see something, you know, look the other way. And so all these little things where you can think about yourself, am I doing that in certain moments, or you know, when does that happen and why does that happen? And so that was very interesting to me.
Let me take a step back. So you decide you're going to do it. What is your first introduction to Cate Blanchett? I'm assuming you didn't know her before this. Did you have a Zoom? Did you meet in person? What was the first conversation?
The great thing was, so Cate and our path had never crossed, but because we both did a lot of theater, we kind of had a common friendship, how do you say this, ground or so, you know? Mm-hmm. So we knew several people where we knew, Cate, I just worked with her. So this kind of thing. So we knew about each other on that level. And then I was shooting Jack Ryan season 3 in Budapest in spring 2001. And I knew by then that I would do Tar later that year. And I was sitting in the breakfast room, and we were all, there were several productions shooting in Budapest. And since it was still the pandemic, we were kind of like in exile. You know, we were all having breakfast and lunch and dinner whenever you had time, you know. So you would meet everyone there. And all of a sudden, I see her back there in the room. Cate Blanchett comes around the corner, and I'm sitting there with my colleague and friend, Adam. And he says, oh my God, Cate Blanchett's coming. And I was like, oh my God, I know that I'm gonna do this job. But I didn't really know, does she know me? Awkward, you know.
So I'm so tense right now.
Yeah.
What's going to happen?
So she came walking towards me, like kind of in her thoughts, and looked up because I was sitting near the exit, looked up and went, like, Nina! You know? And I was like, whew, yeah. And then Adam was like, but you know her? You know? So that was a great, great moment. So I knew, okay, ice is broken, all good. And then we met. You know, we met up, we had dinner, we had lunch, and got to know each other on a very personal, private level, and started talking about guitar, of course, but also not at all, you know. Mm. So that made it so easy later in the year to meet again and start working on this.
I love it.
Yeah, that was really great.
You said before one of the great things about this film is that you don't have to know much or anything about classical music. It helps if you do, but you don't have to. Mm-hmm. At the same time, was it fascinating for you to learn about the importance of a concertmaster, which is what Sharon is in this orchestra? What was interesting about that to you?
Because I had no idea. I play the piano. I once was considering going down the road of an opera singer, so I had a lot of music lessons, but I didn't really know the whole construction or system of an orchestra and what all these positions really mean. So I learned that the concertmaster is the most powerful position you can have within the orchestra, because you are basically the communicator. You keep the orchestra happy and together, and you are the translator to what the conductor tries to find, the sound the conductor tries to find. And you know technically how to possibly achieve that, but you have to communicate it to the whole gang. Yeah. And if you have that chair, you're constantly being challenged. So you can't lean back or anything. Everyone wants this position. And everyone checks on you every day. And you kind of have to hold a certain authority, but also being a people's person, you know. And it's very rare, if not, I actually don't know about a female concertmaster, because it's this kind of, it's still a very patriarchal, in the classical music world, it's still a very patriarchal system. Mm. Where slowly females break through, but this particular position, because it holds so much responsibility, still it's a bit like a pilot or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's still something very special that a woman achieves that. So that, of course, told me everything about Sharon
And her skills,
and her tenacity, because it's, you go through hardship to get to this position, and you don't give it up lightly. You know? So yeah, it was fascinating.
So once you were on the set, working with Todd Field, who, you know, was this kind of mysterious guy, hadn't made a movie in over a decade, and then the legendary Cate Blanchett, what about working with each of them was particularly eye-opening or surprising to you in their process?
Well, it was just that I felt with Todd, I'm working here with a real artist, which means he's very free and open-minded, but at the same time, he's very precise in what he's looking for. And that is a fantastic combination, because it gives you a frame within you're working within, but within that, it's yours to explore. And that is just the best. I love that very much. And the way that Cate literally attacked this character was, you know, to me, Cate and me, we were both scared when we learned from Todd. Sadly, we have to start the shoot with doing all the scenes in the with the orchestra, because the orchestra didn't have another slot. And just these 2 weeks in Dresden with the Dresden Philharmonics, we have to do it at the very beginning. And we were both like, oh my God, I had to learn all these pieces. She had to learn conducting it. And for her, you know, she plays the beginning, the middle, and the end. So for me as Sharon, that was great, because I saw the whole character of Lydia evolving in front of my eyes. And I knew all of that. When we went back to our apartment, you know. So in a way, it was fantastic to start like that.
Yeah.
And to have this, that was very special, basically. I mean, to see her without having really been able to explore it, because we didn't shoot any of these scenes, and her whole arc, I mean, what she pulled off there is just mind-blowing. So, it was just great to watch her.
It's remarkable, but it's also remarkable to see the two of you together. I mean, it's all the stuff with the two of you. You're really going toe-to-toe with her in a fascinating way.
Thank you.
Did the two of you come up with any kind of joint backstory on the history of Lydia and Sharon, or did you just rely on what Todd had written?
No, we did talk about the backstory, how they met, possibly how what their life was before the pandemic, in the pandemic. I mean, that was a big thing as well. You don't think about it so much, and that's totally fine in the film because it's just mentioned once, I think. Mm-hmm. But it is, they just came out as a couple with a little girl out of these pandemic times where these two met through music, and they couldn't do it. So they couldn't do what they love doing. So it probably drove them crazy. Mm. So we talked about that. What do they come out of, and why is this a little fragile, their relationship, you know? And then she is kind of creating this legacy of finishing the whole Mahler cycle, and you know, Lydia is somehow, Sharon is losing her a little bit, you know, and yeah.
So how did they meet?
Well, they met because that's what we came up with. They met through Lydia Tarr being a guest conductor at this orchestra. And Sharon was already in the first chair position. And as you get to learn throughout the film, that Sharon played a big part in getting Lydia this position.
Right.
So in my mind, they traveled the world with symphonies, they had a huge success. They're the couple in Berlin, you know. And I know what that means. You meet the mayor, you're like in the elite of that city, you know, and then also New York, and then so for Sharon also that's a big deal. It opened up the world to her, you know, not just as a concertmaster, but as the wife of someone like Lydia Tarr, you know. It's a lot to lose.
Yeah. When you watch the movie, it feels in many ways like a high wire act on all of your parts. I mean, because it's so precise and so technically challenging. What do you think back as being one of the scenes that you were most challenged by or maybe most nervous to shoot when you read it or were preparing for it?
Well, I guess the last one. Because I didn't quite know where it would take us and what's the right balance of being emotional or not, or how do we shoot it? So once I got to learn, when we rehearsed it, Todd then had the idea, I think we need to do this in a one take. Mm. So in a way, the camera follows Lydia because she's the one that leads us. But then whenever Sharon sinks into the picture, you know, what is the tone? What is the thing? So all of that, I thought, oh, I hope I hit it, you know? So that is the, because it's a choreography at the same time, but also just like, it needs to be real. Mm. And I was looking forward to it, but it was challenging.
You are very accomplished. You've been at this for many years. What would you say this film and this role allowed you to do that maybe you hadn't done much or at all before?
Well, so many aspects of it, really. I mean, this whole preparation phase, which informed me so much about who this person is, and being able to do that with musicians, with a whole gang of an orchestra, then being together with Kate and Todd, who are intense, phenomenal artists, where you just go, yay, you know, you just want to run with it. That is just, I'll never forget it. It changed me,
All right.
It's just I think it's the constellation, the whole thing in itself, that it was really incomparable.
when people who are close to you, friends and family, saw the trailer or saw the film, did they want to know what it was like to kiss Cate Blanchett?
Of course.
And what did you say?
It's a private thing.
I will allow it. What was the experience like for you then to see it? To see the whole finished project, having gone through the process and maybe imagining in your mind's eye what the film would end up looking and feeling like, to then see it. What was that experience like?
Wayne, I had to see it three times to actually be able to say I've seen the film. Because wow. The first time, that's how it is in film, isn't it? There is a big chunk of things that didn't make it into the film. So you have to kind of go, oh, we're here already, okay. But it makes completely sense. It has to be that way. And that's the thing about killing your darlings, isn't it? But you have to kind of go, whoa. So the whole, from the script to the film, something shifted. And so that was my first experience watching it. And then the second one, knowing all that, you kind of go, you know. Then you just watch the film and you follow this immense ride. And I still had the feeling I need to see it again because I missed things. I missed something. Even though I have read it, I was in it. Right. I watched. And then the third time I thought, oh yeah, now I get it.
Wow.
Now I've seen it.
It's interesting because now that the movie has been out for a bit, people are becoming obsessed with it already. And I've read some theories that some people think the whole last act is a dream. Everybody has different theories and
isn't that
thoughts.
Great?
What's your feeling on what people are coming up with?
Yes, some are really feeling, some are really sad for her. Some think this is a new beginning. That's who she actually is. And maybe everything comes together and maybe she blew it up unknowingly. Because that wasn't who she is. And you know what I find so interesting? For me, what is really told me what to think about the last bit is how seriously Lydia works on the last piece. It's the same kind of sincerity and seriousness that she works on the music. So... Mm. For me, she will make it in whatever way. Maybe not in the way that we all think that's success or this is what's needed.
Right. Well.
But there's something comes. It's she as a whole. But then you know, I'll watch it tomorrow maybe, and I come out and go, no, it's terrible. So I don't know. You know.
Here's the last thing. I'm curious to know now that you've gone through this entire experience and process. What is your bond now with Cate? I noticed the two of you showed up at one event, I think it was your Academy Q&A, with the exact same outfit on. What kind of fun are you having with her, and what's the bond that you two share?
Yeah, we're having fun. We're having fun. Because she's up for all these things, you know. I just made a joke. Oh, maybe, you know, we should wear the same similar things together. Because I was wearing something, she then got that thing in a photo shoot. And then she said, look, I try to, you know, copy you. And I'm like, oh. You know? And that's how it happened. And then she said, of course, yeah, let's do it. And I'm like, whoa. And then her stylist, dun, 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 you know.
And there were two of the same.
And I love that. You know, it's just what we just did. It was not a big boom, right. You know. But it's just having fun a little bit with all of this.
Can we expect you to dress similarly again, or is that a one-time thing?
I don't know.
Okay. I can't wait to see what you come up with, Nina Haas. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. The movie is Tar. If you haven't seen it, go treat yourself to this phenomenal, fascinating film. Great to see you.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So look, here's what I will say about this. I cannot imagine for the life of me acting opposite Cate Blanchett, and yet Nina Haas had to do it, and she does it so well. Josh, there was a word you've used in conversations, how locked in she is Is that right?
Yes. And not only does it so well, but apparently she very much enjoyed it. I've heard from a lot of actors that playing against Cate Blanchett is all sorts of shades of intimidating. And, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of makes sense. But Nina Haas is fearless. She's a fearless mm-hmm. performer.
Well, and that goes a very long way. You know, when you can see that someone is unafraid, I mean, maybe they are privately, but if it doesn't show up on the screen, that goes a long way, because so many characters present so many, you know, vulnerable layers, things you don't want to have to explore and, you know, present on screen, but they do it in such humanizing ways. And she seems to be one of those actresses who just delivers and brings the goods. So if folks have not seen Tar, it is certainly one that is going to pick up several Oscar nominations. And, you know, certainly the team there is hoping that Nina is one of them. So be sure to check that one out as well. All right, Clarissa, any parting words before we sign off here on your last official awardist podcast with EW?
Oh, well, I will miss talking with you, but I will be cheering both of you on as a listener. That'll be super exciting. Oh. And I'm sure I will see you throughout award season, because it's not over yet.
Indeed. You will see us. You know, I said I can't imagine acting opposite Cate Blanchett. You're my Cate Blanchett.
Yes, Clarissa. I was about to say, and if we sneak into your new office with a microphone and a podcast invitation, don't be surprised. It's part of
exactly. You. we know where to find you.
Oh, you certainly do.
Yeah. All right. Well, Clarissa and Josh, thank you both so much. And thanks to all of you for listening. That is it for this episode of The Awardist. If you like what you heard, follow, rate the podcast, and leave us an award-winning review on Apple Podcasts. And to keep the conversation with us going, you can follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials at EW on Twitter and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. And feel free to tag me. I'm at Jared Hall. We will see you right back here next week. This episode of The Awardist Podcast is hosted by Jared Hall, produced by Chanel Johnson and Sammy Junio, edited by Sammy Junio. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.